Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this extra episode, if you have a wildly popular show on public radio and you're funny by nature, you might just decide to sit on the couch and polish more one-liners. But something prompted NPR's Peter Sagal to take up running around the age of 40. That journey is the subject of his new book, The Incomplete Book of Running. Peter Sagal is the host of NPR's long-running news quiz, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. He spoke with KUOW's Ross Reynolds at Seattle First Baptist Church on November 11th. Town Hall Seattle presented the event as part of their Arts and Culture series.
So I'm very curious, how many of you knew that Peter Sagal was a runner? Oh, fair number of folks.
It's nice to know.
Peter, I've heard that Larry King never reads the books, and his first thing that he says to authors is, so you wrote a book.
Yes.
But I'm not going to do that.
My last book, which is for sale. thank you. I did a book tour, and one author, who's a public radio guy, it was a little embarrassing, hadn't read the book, so he interviewed me about the table of contents. I noticed you have a chapter here titled that. What's that about? I said, well, it's sort of in the title there. Anyway, sorry, didn't mean to interrupt.
So, Peter, why run?
Why run? Well, sometimes, it's funny. Sometimes people say, well, I would only run if something were chasing me. And I realized I kind of did that. It was true. I was, as the book describes, I ran some when I was a younger man, much younger man in high school, quite obsessively, in fact. But gave it up as I got a job and a family and a marriage and all those other things that sort of weigh you down. And that was probably more emotionally laden than I meant it to be. Moving on. But what happened was I was about to turn 40. This was some years ago. Although, weirdly, I looked exactly the same. And I don't mean by that that I'm very youthful now. I looked old then. And I just said, oh my God, I'm going to turn 40, which hadn't seemed possible some years before. And I realized that meant, if you turn 40, that means you're eventually going to turn 50, and that's then 60, and then you will die. I figured that out. And I said to myself, well, if I run a marathon, I won't die. It's worked so far. And
but your father ran. And
my father ran.
Which you kind of mocked him for.
I did, yeah. When I was growing up, my father was part of that 70s running boom that, in fact, was inspired in part by Jim Fix's Complete Book of Running, which my book, as you can tell, is the cover is kind of an homage. He had his beautiful sculpted legs running along perfectly, and now that's that. Those are my legs, by the way, and I put that in the back so you can prove it. Anyway, and so he was part of that, and he inspired me ultimately to start running after making fun of him for doing it for a long time, and so that's why the book is dedicated to him. He's still around. He doesn't run anymore because, you know, who has time for that shit? but to go back to your original question, I mean, it turns out that the reasons I started running seriously was it actually was, I think, things chasing me. Mortality, a sense of being, and this is, I think, true of my father when he started 30 years before, a sense of being stuck in one place and sinking slowly into that place. And wanting to get a move on, and I just did it more literally than some.
Well, there were things going on in your personal life. Your marriage was falling apart, and I read you're kind of gravitating towards running in part as something that you could control, and you couldn't control this other part of your life.
It's interesting. What's weird, and I mean this literally, I wrote this whole book over the course of some years, published it. You know, went over to, when you publish a book, you go over and over it again. I read it out loud. Into it for the audiobook, and it was only after that, and I've started this book tour to talk about it, when I realized that it probably wasn't, in fact, a coincidence that my late life athletic career involving running long distances coincided with the declining years of my marriage. There's running, and there's running away. And it's probable that I was doing more of that than I thought at the time.
You were once asked, why run if it's so painful? And your response was, that's the point.
Yes. That, in fact, was my ex-wife. I came back from my second or third marathon, and if you've ever met anybody after a marathon, you know what they're like. They're walking like the Walking Dead, and sort of shambling. And I was trying to get my way up the like 8 steps to our front porch, and she looked at me. She said, why do you do this if it hurts so much? And I said, that's the point. Which I was trying to conjure up my best, Lawrence of Arabia. You know, the trick is not to mind, But, and I do think that for a while, and perhaps still for many people, we do these things to kind of feel. The pain, the suffering is kind of the point, because let's face it, most of us have it pretty easy, certainly compared to like every infinite number of generations of humans that have come before us. We don't even, we don't even have to walk most of the time, let alone hunt food. And because life is so easy, I think a lot of people, maybe especially men, going through midlife crises, want to do something difficult so that you know you can, or that you can feel something. It's like a weird midlife crisis version of cutting. It's like, I know, it's gross, but I'll come up with a less insensitive metaphor later on. But I actually came to understand, if I went on a journey, it was this, that that is in fact not the point, that you don't want to be miserable, that we are miserable enough already, that the pleasure of running for me, and I think for most people who attempt it, and can, most people can attempt it, but there are other things that I think provide this to other people who don't want to run, is the pleasure of preparation, execution, and I guess, for lack of a better term, readiness. If you've trained well and you step to, when I first stepped to the starting line of a marathon, the first time I said, oh my God, this is gonna hurt. This is gonna hurt. I got ready to hurt. And as I got better at it and more wise about it, I got ready. I mean, I stood there and instead of saying, this is gonna hurt, I said, this is gonna be great. I'm ready. Let's do this. And I think that's a better place than sort of looking forward to suffering.
And you're right about one particular race that where you seem to transcend the pain and the agony and reach some amazing place. Could you talk about that race?
Well, I'm not quite sure what you mean, but there was one race that I kind of learned this, and this may be not the one you mentioned. It was a marathon that I had signed up for in October, and in August of that year, I was hit by a car, an orange Nissan, which haunts my dreams. And it laid me up in the hospital and broke a couple of bones in my back, and I wanted to run the marathon, so I decided to run the marathon. And I figured I'd just run. I was going to run with a friend of mine, and I would eventually crap out after a few miles and send him on his way. But what happened was, because I didn't have any expectation I would even finish it, let alone do well, I started it with, no expectations. And I just kept going until I figured I'd need to stop, and I never needed to stop. And I ended up running one of my best marathons to that date. And that's when I was like, oh, you don't have to punish yourself every second in order to achieve something. You can forgive yourself and see what happens. And I've been trying to do that in a lot of things ever since.
You know, it's inspiring to read the book. It made me almost want to start running until I got to the section on egress.
Oh, egress, yes. I felt, we all know the primary reason you're here, which is my radio show, and I felt that I needed to include some poop jokes to stay on brand. And yeah, so one of the chapters, I mean, it was really funny. I wrote a version of that for Runner's World, and I said to my editor, like some X number of years ago, I said, if I ever want to submit a column about uncontrollable pooping, you've known I'm out of ideas. And then I sent him the chapter on uncontrollable pooping and kept writing, so I guess I didn't. So yes, well, I wanted to talk about the fact that sometimes running is really bad. sometimes it sucks. And this is a problem I've dealt with. Can't believe I'm talking to an entire audience in a church about this, but you know. Anyway, so yes, that's a thing that happens. It happens to me. It's happened to other runners, leading to the most unpleasant conversations. But it's something that, that you can read about.
I get the sense from reading your book that you have kind of already reached the pinnacle of your running, and you're running for different reasons now than when you were at your
peak. And that may change, but right now, I mean, what happened was, as I describe in the book, I decided to train up and run a marathon to see if I could do it as fast as I humanly could, and I did, and I achieved that, and you can read about that. But after that, I kind of lost steam, you know? I was like, it was sort of like, you know, we've been to the moon, now where do we go? I ran a really fast marathon, not what I do. And I was at sea for a little while. In fact, the next year was the first year in like 7 years I hadn't run a marathon. But then actually what happened was eventually I got a call from a guy I did not know, but he knew I was a runner, and he called me up and he said, would you like to come guide a blind runner at the Boston Marathon? And I was like, okay. And that happened, not by coincidence, to coincide with the destruction of my marriage and my family. And it wasn't a coincidence that he called me then. It was not a coincidence that I said yes, because I kind of needed to get out of the house and was taking any excuse I could to do so. And so I ended up in Boston, and this is the opening chapter of the book, running the Boston Marathon with a blind runner. And that was a really amazing experience. It was really an extraordinary pleasure for me to take this skill, which may have no use, really. I mean, one of the things I talk about in the book is I keep trying to think of like what I've trained myself to run very long distances at a reasonable pace. What in the world is that good for? You know, and I have this fantasy which I describe where it's like, I developed this back in high school, as you can imagine, where it was like, you know, we're deep in the woods and there's somebody, probably a beautiful young woman, who's been bitten by a snake. And the only anti-venom is 10 miles away. And of course we have no car, so somebody needs to run there and then run back and be like, I can do it. But barring that scenario, really, I mean, you run down to the store, you jump in the car. I mean, you know, now you've got all these bicycles everywhere. I mean, my God. And to be able to run for someone else to help him achieve his goal felt like a finally something I could do with this. And it came at a time where, as I say in the book, I was not being allowed to take care of my children, so it was a pleasure to take care of somebody else's, and or rather some other person, although I guess we're all God's children. And so we ran that race, and it was a difficult race for him, but a great race for me, because as I said, I was helping somebody, and he gutted it out, and he ran the last mile after having to stop and egress and other things all along the way. And because he ran that last mile, the bravest mile I've ever been a part of, we had made it across the finish line when the bomb went off. And so that's sort of what starts the book. Sort of a surprise. I wasn't expecting that, but we were just 100 yards over the line when the bomb.
And you went back to run another marathon.
Yeah, well, and the course of the book is, the loose frame of the book is, after the 2013 Boston Marathon, which was the one with the bombing, everybody who was there, everybody who had finished, especially the people who hadn't been able to finish, and including eventually some of the people who were gravely injured, decided that we were all going to come back and run that race again. Because there was talk of them, well, we'll ever have the Boston Marathon again. Oh my God, they've reached and they're going to bomb marathons now. We can't have marathons. And if I may do something and say something that you've probably never heard me say, the entire running community said, fuck that. And we all came back in force the next year and ran it again. And I ran it again as a guide for another blind runner, a guy named Eric Mansell.
You write about runners who have inspired you, and some of those runners are the blind runners who you helped to guide.
Well, I mean, these guys are amazing. It just so happens that the runners I run with are men, but they're obviously visually impaired women who run. In fact, one of the women my first year actually outran. She was such a great runner. She was an elite level runner. She was one of the fastest, if not the fastest, visually impaired woman runner in the world. And for a runner like that, somebody who can run at an elite pace, you can't find like five, you can't find an elite person to run with her. So what they do is they do it in stages. Usually for someone who's very fast, 10K. So you run 10K, 6 miles, and you're handed off to somebody else who'll run that pace with you for another 6 miles. And she actually, her guide for the first 10K couldn't keep up with her. And he said, "I'm sorry, I can't keep this up." He was just dying. And she's not going to slow down. She's there to win the thing. And so she's like, great. So she is, I believe, completely blind. And she's just running the Boston Marathon, saying, "Hey, everybody, tell me if I'm going to hit you." And just boom. So that's the woman. The men I were with still were people. I mean, like William Greer, the guy I ran the first time, he was hit by a car when he was 17 years old. And it smashed on the pavement the back of his head. And so what he has is what's called cortical blindness, i.e. his eyes work fine, but his visual cortex was severely damaged. And what that means is like you're looking at me right now, and you're not even thinking you're seeing a short, bald man talking. I mean, you just recognize it. It's not a conscious effort. For him, that all got messed up, so he has to figure out what he's seeing consciously almost every minute. Like, okay, that's, you know, I'm looking around going, well, obviously there are lights up there, and I'm looking back there, and they're sort of different shapes. So I bet the middle one, that's probably, that's how his brain works. And despite that tremendous handicap, he's had an amazing life, and he decided, just like I did, he was going to start running marathons when he got toward 40. And, you know, it's very important not to make these people saints. They're not. They're just people who happen to have a physical disability. But they, in my experience, approach the challenges that life has given them. And obviously, it's a self-selecting group because these are people who choose to run marathons. But they just go about it without any sense of self-pity, without any sense of privilege. They're just like, well, this is something I want to do. I can't see, so I need to make other arrangements. So let's make those arrangements so I can go do it. And I find that kind of inspiring, especially as someone who is inclined to being morose and self-pitying.
You became the object of vilification in the running world.
I did.
Something I'd never heard of, called banditing.
Oh, yes.
What is banditing?
So if you've ever participated in a race, you know this. If you've ever seen a race, you know this. Like, if you've ever watched the Seattle Marathon, to take an example, you'll see the people running by, and they all got these bibs on them with a number. And that bib means they have paid a registration fee to run the race. In fact, we often just say, by virtue of metonymy, oh, do you have a bib? Who has a bid for that race? Meaning, who has a paid entry? Metonymy, I was an English major. thing for the whole, it's a kind of, anyway. And if you were to run a race without doing that, i.e. paying the requisite fee and registering, and I'll say in passing that these fees can be sometimes very high. I think it's like $300 now for the Boston Marathon, I'm not sure. Certainly north of $200. You are banditing that race. You are a bandit, i.e. someone who is stealing whatever. And it happens all the time. I mean, as a matter of fact, many years ago, before everything changed, there was a group of people who bandited Boston every year. It was just a thing they did. They were like hipster runners, and they didn't want to pay, so they just waited until the whole thing went off, and then they waited like a requisite 10 minutes, and then they started, and they just ran the race. And everybody's like, all right, it's a thing. People do it. No, it's not, it turns out. I did it as a training run. I had to run 20 miles to get ready for my own marathon. It was the day of the Chicago Marathon. So I just jumped onto the course at mile 5 and got off it at mile 25 and walked away and felt great. And I would have gotten away scot-free
if only.
I hadn't blogged about it. Always the downfall of the master criminal. And I literally became the most hated person in running for like 2 weeks. I got letters, like handwritten letters telling me how off. Who takes the time to handwrite a letter? This woman wrote to me. She says, Peter, you know, and she described how she's raised her children and she raised them to believe in honesty and integrity and how I destroyed the entire ethos that she had been trying to instruct her children in.
But she'll never band it again.
No, I'll
you
never band it. No, I've learned my lesson.
And not just because of the vilification, right? You also learned there's a reason.
Well, yeah. I mean, so this happened, and I was like, what do I do? And I was like, well, I could write about it. And so at the time, what I did is, because everybody's telling me, like, this is really bad. You did a terrible thing. And I'm like, well, I just ran on the street with everybody else. And it was the streets were closed anyway, so I didn't, like, delay any traffic individually. And I did have one cup of Gatorade, and I feel kind of bad about that. But seriously, I mean, it really seemed, like, disproportionate to the offense, the anger and rage. So I ended up, like, doing an inquiry into the level of my turpitude. And so you can read about it, but basically what I came to understand is, no, I did not steal anything of value from the organizers of the Chicago Marathon. The organizer of the Chicago Marathon told me that himself. What I did, though, was I took advantage of all the other people who had gone through, not only the other people who had, like, paid their fee and signed up and done what they needed to do to be there legitimately, but all the people who volunteered, all the cops who cleared the roads, all even the people who had to sit there and wait or go around because they were running the marathon. Like, all these people decided, actually learned this from a Kantian philosopher at Harvard, all these people that decided to donate their time or their energy or their money to this endeavor, and I just strolled in and took it.
So don't band it, or don't blog about it if you do.
Yes, exactly. Keep it quiet.
Did you go for a run today, Peter?
I did. This was actually great fun. I have become friends, and I'm very fortunate, with a wonderful woman named Lauren Fleshman. Lauren Fleshman was one of the elite distance runners of modern American history. She was the, I think, 3 or 4-time NCAA champion. She's one of those runners who did everything but win at the Olympics. She had 2 badly timed injuries, so you would have heard of her had she gone to the Olympics and won, which she was on track to do. Lauren introduced me. Lauren walked away from Nike. Have you heard of Nike? because she felt that their relationship with athletes was exploitive. And she connected with a Seattle-based company called Wiselle, O-I-S-E-L-L-E. And Lauren introduced me to Sally Bergeson, who founded and runs Wiselle, who's an amazing woman and a great runner and a lovely person. And so today we met up at the Wiselle flagship store in University Village with about 40 people, and we did a run together around the horticultural trail, which is very nice. And what was amazing was every single person, there was 40 people, all shapes and sizes, mostly women because it's Wiselle, and they all said the same thing. They all said, you can see the mountain today.
it's
running along. It's like, oh, well, Peter, you'll be able to see the mountain in just a minute. And I'm like, that's great. Thank you. Yes. And then literally, like, somebody would, like, run up. And like, Peter, can you, Mount Rainier, over there. So it's a very nice mountain, Seattle.
So... This is a thing now. When you're on tour with Wait,
yeah,
run groups will invite you to go running.
Many times I either informally set it up with friends. In fact, I had a great time here once. It was about 10 years ago that I was coming to Seattle to do Wait, and I wanted to go for a run, and so I called up a running store here in Seattle, and I said, hi, I'm coming to town, and I'm looking to go for a run on Thursday morning, and the guy said, well, we don't have any group runs on Thursday morning. Our group runs are Friday or whenever they were. I'll go with you. So this guy met me, he and his friend, who were both like ultra trail runners. And they took me in this great tour of Chicago. I think it was the first time I came up here. We're in Capitol Hill, right? So the first time I got up here, and I remember they were carrying their own water bottles strapped to their hand. I'd never seen that before. They're common now. And I was like, oh, yeah, those are interesting. He said, yeah, we use them during races because those paper cups, the waste, it's unconscionable. And I'm like, this is a Seattle moment. I enjoy it. So I do that. I do that from time to time.
I always thought if I did take up running, that would be my opportunity to listen to all those podcasts I never get a chance to listen to. But you're actually... against the idea of listening to something.
I am against headphones, although I mean, I'm not against headphones as a principle. I'd rather use headphones than play your goddamn music in the subway, okay? Just use headphones.
Or wait, don't tell me.
Wait, don't tell me. You're perfectly fine. But this is actually something I came to slowly. When I first started running, I wore headphones all the time, including in races, and then I realized if you're going to race, if you're going to attempt something difficult that you've trained for, you should at least be paying attention to what you're doing. And so I gave it up, and I remember, I was hosting a race. I was like the MC of a race, and it was a 5K, meaning for a lot of people it was their first race, and I was watching people get ready, and they were all, you know, strapping their iPhones or whatever they were at that time to their upper arms and putting in their headphones. And I said, hey, everybody, and I didn't mean to say this, I said, hey, everybody, I notice you're all putting in headphones. Take them out. And they all looked at me like, what? And I said, you're about to run a 5K race that's 3 miles. Let's say you run a 10-minute mile, which is a decent but not onerous pace. That means you're going to be spending half an hour out there. You can spend half an hour without input. Try it. And I've become something of a advocate for that, especially as the years have gone on. And we don't spend any time without any input anymore. We go from screen to screen to screen. I'm sure a lot of you, like me, the first thing you do when you wake up is reach for the phone and see what else he's been up to. And, you know, maybe you'll end your day relaxing in front of a large screen, which hopefully takes all your attention. And when you don't have, when you can't look at a screen because you're driving or doing a chore or whatever, you put in earphones and listen to your podcast. And that's how we live, I guess. I live that way. But you should have a moment in your day where you just don't have any input, because you can find out what's going on. This part of the book was excerpted in the New York Times, and people responded to it on Twitter, which I was staring at first thing in the morning. And one guy said, I don't know, I mean, I run races. He's a very good runner, like 315 marathoner. He's like, I got to listen to music or podcast, because he said, my thoughts and I don't get along well. And I understand that. I understand, you know, that little voice. I mean, sometimes that little voice inside your head is saying, you suck. And I understand you don't want to listen to it. But if you say your thoughts and you don't get along, shouldn't you spend time together? I mean, if I said to you, myself and my wife don't get along, you know, which is not actually a hypothetical. I mean, you don't say, well, just, you know, ignore each other. You say, spend time together. Try to figure out what's going on. Get to know each other. So I told him, get to know your own thoughts. I don't know if he's ever going to do it. But I'm beginning to think like this is actually essential to just think and not have somebody else's thoughts or art being pumped into your brain to drown out your own.
You did a PBS series on the Constitution.
I did, yeah.
Can we talk about the Constitution for a little bit?
Yeah, I can go on. How much time do we got? Because I can go on about this.
Well, I have a specific question for you.
All right. Let me briefly say that I did a documentary for PBS 5 years ago now called Constitution USA with Peter Sagal, in which we ran around the country and talked to people about sort of current contemporary issues of constitutional law, the idea being that we're not going to, like, show you pan across paintings of long dead white guys in wigs and show you boxes like federal, you know, the judiciary and the legislature. We're actually going to show you how it actually works today with real people. So that was the idea of the
documentary. You know, we like to call ourselves a democracy, and yet the Electoral College.
Yes.
Two senators for every state, no matter what size it is.
One of the things that I learned, and this is easy to forget, is that the U.S. Constitution and the country it created was one of the greatest leaps forward in human civilization. And I know we're very attuned right now to our failings. And I know this is Seattle, where we're particularly attuned. But I was talking to a esteemed professor of constitutional law named Akhil Reed Amar, he may be the smartest human being I've ever spoken to, and he said, the U.S. Constitution, he said, in its drafting and ratification in 1787, was, to use his phrase, the hinge of history. And I said, what do you mean? He said, prior to that time, more or less, with very few exceptions, humanity ruled itself through force. And it was disguised in many ways, but that's what it was. It was the guys, always guys, with the most weapons or the most powerful army ruling over everybody else. That's what it was. And in 1787, an entire continent, more people than had ever been able to do this before. Because remember, earlier experiments of democracy, Roman Republic, Greece, it was very, very limited to very small groups of people. And of those people, very, very small fractions of those people were allowed to participate in the supposed democracy. But no, we're going to let an entire continent of people vote on how they shall govern themselves. I know. It was just the guys. I know. I know. As I said, I know. And so, and it has progressed slowly, haltingly, with some backsliding, to be the light of the world. I became an absolute believer in the, if you will, American exceptionalism. And I, and that is a thrilling thing to understand, that we here in the United States, I mean, let me put it this way. We're unique in many ways, our country. One of the ways in which we are unique is that there is no, despite what people might tell you, common ethnicity, culture, or religion in the United States. We come from all over the world, like our ancestors were thrown out of every self-respecting country. Or escaped, or fled. And we all live in this vast continent, and until quite recently with the digital age, every place was very different from every other place, with different cultures and mores and different problems and advantages. But we all got along and we all made it work together somehow. And so what was it that bound us together? What made us Americans? It's not, you know, any of the things that make, say, Norwegians Norwegians or Koreans Koreans or Russians Russians. There's no like common language even or culture, or you know, you can say, if you live in Norway, right, I mean, you can talk about 1,000 years of Norwegian history of which you are the current progenitor. We don't do that. What binds us together? What binds us together, and this is skipping a lot, is a kind of civic religion. We don't share the same religion, but we all share, or we should, this kind of civic religion, which we believe, to take obvious examples that were quite agreed upon until recently, if you lose an election, if your guy or gal loses an election, you get angry, you get upset, but you accept the fact the other guy won, and then you work very hard toward the next one. If you have a dispute with your neighbor, you don't get your friends together and get their guns or their swords or whatever it may be and go kill your neighbor to take the thing that you think belongs to you, you go to court. And if the court rules against you, you accept the judgment. We know that we will settle our differences, as bitter as they are, through democracy and the rule of law, and that we all, whoever we may be, from the lowliest recent citizen to the President of the United States, I'm speaking for the moment in the abstract. We will subject ourselves unto this authority of the Constitution, this authority of democracy. And I think it's beautiful. And I think for all of its flaws, it's an amazing thing. And to the extent that we have advanced this, we should be proud. Barack Obama, one of my favorite thing that Barack Obama ever did is not as well known as some of his other speeches, but I think it's amazing, you should all read it, which is his speech on the 50th anniversary of Selma. Because what had happened, I don't know if you remember this, no reason you should, Rudolph Giuliani had gotten up and made a speech, and he said, you know, I just don't think our president believes in America. I just don't think he cares about America. I'm sorry to say that. Yeah, right. I just don't think he believes in America. And apparently Barack Obama got pretty upset by that. I mean, a lot of stuff, as it had to, rolled off his back, but that bothered him. So he took the occasion of the 50th anniversary speech at Selma, and John Lewis was there, and a lot of survivors of that incident were there, and he laid out what it is he believes about America. And essentially, he said it in other forms, but he had never said it more clearly, to my knowledge, then. He talked about a promise that was made, an ideal that was laid out by our founders. You can read it in the preamble, we the people, in order to create a more perfect union, in that the history of America has been people moving us haltingly, sometimes backsliding, but still forward toward a realization of that vision, mainly by including more people in it. And I I think that's great. I think that there's this amazing ideal of America that was laid out by visionaries who instantly failed to meet it, but have given us this dream, this ideal that we have in fact moved towards. But now look. And I could talk a lot about this, and I have in other venues. It gets pretty dire because we've never, to my knowledge and understanding of history, invested as much power in an individual and other individuals around that individual who simply don't believe anything I just said, who don't understand it, who, if it was explained to them, would say, well, that sounds like it's for suckers. And I don't know what's going to happen. I really don't, because the history of the United States, there have always been people who didn't get it. There's always been people who didn't understand. Always people tried to take advantage of it. Always people who rejected it. And we've been able to tolerate that, right? Because there's enough of us. We outweigh them. There's a critical mass of people who believe in democracy. What happens if some of the people who don't are the most powerful people in the country? Well, I think we're about to find out. That was bleak.
All right. Let's turn to the reason that probably most people know you.
Please.
How did you get to be the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me?
Through dumb luck, absolute dumb luck. I was a playwright, screenwriter, freelance guy, living in Brooklyn, making a living, actually. In fact, one of my very first professional productions was a workshop production here at the Seattle Rep, under the direction of Doug Hughes, who was here under Dan Sullivan.
What was the name of the play?
The name of the play was What to Say. It was just done as a workshop. It wasn't a full production, but it was like one of my first professional experiences. I was so excited. I was a real playwright. This was like 1993, I think. And I was doing that, and the phone rang one day, and somebody, it was a friend of mine, Barry Edelstein, is now the artistic director of the Old Globe, and he said, I know these people who are putting together a radio show, and they're looking for funny people who read a lot of newspapers. And I thought of you. I was about to explain what newspapers were, but you're mostly my demographic, you know. And I said, oh, I'd love to be an NPR. I listen to NPR all the time. Wouldn't you love to be an NPR? If somebody asked you to be an NPR, of course I'll be an NPR. So I said yes, and I auditioned to be on the panel, and I was hired, cast, to be on the panel. The original panel of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me in the very first broadcast was myself, Roxanne Roberts, and Roy Blunt Jr. The host was another gentleman who wasn't working out too well, and the show was failing. You're not going to believe this, but public radio is a very conservative culture. And I don't mean politically, I mean they don't like change. And so all of a sudden there was this new show that wasn't that good, and people weren't able to listen to whatever they were listening to before, and people were upset. And there was a lot of pressure being put on the show that had just started, and out of absolute desperation, they said, why don't we try this Sagal guy as host? He seems hosty. So without any training, preparation, or intent, I had never wanted to be a radio host. I became a radio host, and that was 20 years ago. And
you were explaining a little bit earlier that you've got a team of writers that work with you on a script for the program.
Yes.
But back when you first started hosting it, was it you just have to rely on your own wits?
Yeah. The NPR, as you know, is known for its expertise in humor. I'm kidding. NPR as an institution had no idea how to do comedy. Our executive producer was Doug Berman, who had done Car Talk, but Car Talk obviously was based on the personalities, very legitimate, that's who they were, of Tom and Ray. So how do you do a written show? And basically, for a long time, I just wrote it, or tried to write it, and I conducted conversations with our panelists. We had help, but I was like, no, I'm going to write this. But two things really changed, I think, the fortunes of the show. The first was when we started doing it in front of a live audience every week, as opposed to special occasions. And that was back in 2005. For 7 years, we did the show mainly in a studio, which when I think about now, I was like, what were we thinking? A comedy show? Well, we don't want anybody sitting in front of us. They might laugh and interrupt our train of thought. And the other thing that happened was in 2008, we brought in some really wonderful people to be writers and producers. And I had to learn, it was actually almost 10 years into the show, I had to learn how to let other people write for me and not feel weird about it. I remember the first time we had this wonderful producer, a guy named Ian Chillog, who had written a fantastic joke, like something so much better than I could come up with. And I did the joke, and everybody laughed, and I actually said, well, that was Ian Chillog. I didn't want a credit for his joke. It was a really good joke. And I learned something, which you know all the TV hosts know, and because they grew up in the business, that your job is not to just be yourself. Your job is to be the voice of everybody you work with. So when John Oliver is speaking to you, when Stephen Colbert is speaking to you, they're voicing an entire production. It is absolutely my privilege to be the face and the voice of these people, but it is not all me by any stretch of the imagination.
Those of us who've had a chance to see the program realizes that it just unfolds. They're tremendously witty and clever with it. But I got to ask you about the editing process. A reliable source once told me that Car Talk, as funny as it was, they'd sweeten it once in a while with an extra bit of laughter just to kind of punch it up.
We never do that, I'm pleased to say. We edit the show. The show is not live. If you've seen the show in Seattle, you know, because you were there not on Saturday morning, but you were there on Thursday night. So we tape the show, and then we edit it. And to my knowledge, I don't edit the show. They don't let me near it, because I'd be like, don't you think we could use more me? But to my knowledge, we have never added laughter to make a joke sound funnier than it was. We will sometimes, and I don't think they ever did this, I think this is what they were doing in Car Talk, sometimes to cover an edit, we'll put in a laugh, like to cover a sound that otherwise we couldn't get rid of, or to connect two bits of what is now notionally taped together. But it's all real. I mean, everything you hear is real. The panelists aren't warned what we're going to ask them. They haven't rehearsed what they're going to respond with. A lot of what I say turns out to be improvised. Once the panelists hijack what we had written, I start improvising as well. But what we do is we do edit out the bad stuff. And you'd be surprised how much of a difference that makes.
I think I'd like to hear that show.
Yeah, well, everybody says that. Everybody says, well, you know, they come to see the show, and afterwards they go, my God, this was 2 hours and it was so great. Why don't you just broadcast this? And you're like, because you've forgotten all the stuff that died. We just made all these tasteless jokes, and you all stared at us as if we had just, you know. So no, it's best that no one knows.
Your panelists are so quick. Is it hard to kind of be the traffic cop and keep things on track?
Yes, but it's my job. And one of the things about our panelists, somebody asked me who my favorite panelist is, and of course I'm not going to tell you that. But one thing I did say, and it is true, is that we like all our panelists. I like all our panelists. I think they're great people. And one of the things that's great about them is they play well with others. If they didn't, they wouldn't last on the show. So one of the things so everybody's genuinely interested in each other. And nobody wants to Bigfoot anybody else. Nobody wants to shout down anybody else. And that makes it easy to manage it, because everybody wants to get along. It's a lot easier to manage a group of friends who want to have a conversation than it is to manage an argument between people who are trying to, shout each other down.
I want to go to your questions in just a moment, but this is your second book. Got it out of your system?
I don't know. My editor was like, what's your next book? I want to get started on your next book. And I felt like, I apologize for this metaphor, but I felt like a woman who'd just been like through a labor and delivered a baby after 4 years. And her husband says, let's have another one. And you're like, but no, so I'm already thinking about the next book, which I think will be a lot more about those constitutional and civic issues and stuff that I was just talking about.
Great. Well, we've got a lot of running room here, the Constitution. The state of the nation, running.
Fart jokes.
Your question, sir. What's your name?
Kenton.
Kenton?
Kenton.
Yes. What's your question, sir?
My question is, outrunning, have you ever found yourself running in a place where you looked around and went, I shouldn't be here?
That is a good question. Probably. I've run in a lot of places, some of which were kind of dicey. I remember... It was in Des Moines. And I was out running, and I got lost. And I was like, well, maybe if I run around, there's like this junkyard. And I was like, well, if I run around the junkyard, maybe I can get back to the road. And I ran past the junkyard into the woods. So I'm running the woods, and like there's this chain link fence and rotting cars, and then in front of me is like this old mobile home with just a little smoke coming out of it. And I'm like, I'm going to be skinned.
And you weren't running with anyone else?
No, I was totally by myself. But no, I've been blessed, and I'm going to say this is partly because I am a man. This is not a freedom that women have, which is an absolute goddamn tragedy. That I can pretty much run anywhere and assume that no one's going to mess with me, because why would you want to mess with a short, sweaty guy who clearly has no money on him? And so I've never had to worry. I just wish that were true of women, because it isn't.
There's also a microphone on this side if you want to have a question for Peter. Yes, sir, what's your name and what's your question?
John Murphy. Peter, thanks. That inspired me to ask, I'm from Chicago, so I'm wondering what your favorite route is in Chicago, and or your favorite route or some version of
Chicago, we don't have a lot in terms of natural beauty compared to Seattle. You can stare all you want, no mountain will ever appear. But we do have a beautiful lakefront trail. And as I've traveled around, especially the Midwest, the fact that we have this thing is incredibly rare. And in fact, you can kind of see what I mean in Seattle. Seattle was founded like Chicago because it was on a body of water that was going to be used for commerce, so it was developed for commerce, still used, obviously. Which means that it's not that accessible for like human-sized people. In Chicago, well, it can be. I'm sure that in the last few years they've created esplanades and such. But in Chicago, thanks to the fact that it burned down, and then this guy named Daniel Burnham was put in charge of planning out the city of Chicago, and he came up with this idea that the lakeshore should be forever free, to use the phrase. And so with one silly exception, there's nothing between Lakeshore Drive and the lake. That means there's a 20-mile path going north-south along the lake in Chicago, and every weekend and most weekdays during the summer, it is just filled with people. It's a parade of runners and bicyclists, and I run into people I know on it. And so one of the things about it is it's a very civic kind of engagement. Everybody's out there together. It's really fun. I love that place. I love Waterfall Glen, if you know that. But I can tell you, I mean, Seattle, I love running around Green Lake. In Portland, I love running in Forest Park. I love running the Esplanade in San Francisco and up in the Headlands. I mean, I've been very lucky. I've gone around the country.
Yes, what's your name and what's your question?
Hi, I'm Carrie.
Hi, Carrie.
Do you remember talking to me about 19 and a half years ago?
It depends. What did I say?
I won the Listener Limerick Challenge, and you made fun of my daughter's name. You.
Sounds like me. What is your daughter's name?
Her name is Wallace.
Wallace.
And you were like, well, good thing you were not reading Fishing Weekly or whatever it was, because then you would have named her Walleye. I can't remember exactly your joke.
I'm not saying you're lying. I'm just having trouble believing I could ever be that incredibly lame.
I have a recording.
What?
I have a recording of it. I'm not lying, but that wasn't my question.
Okay. You just wanted to get up and mortify me, and then you're going to sit down.
I was going to say, is there a question there?
That's fine. Well, I deserve it.
It's like turnabout is fair play. Not at all. So I hate running so much, and I was wondering if you would go for a run with me, like Washington Boulevard, tomorrow.
Like now?
No, tomorrow.
Like
we have a day off. You want to?
Next time I'm in Seattle.
Oh, wait.
I will be happy, because I have to get up in the morning and go, but I'm happy to, sure, absolutely. Yeah.
Because I hate it, and maybe it inspired me to run.
But in lieu of me, because I'm not easily available, you should, in fact, find somebody else you'd like to spend some time with.
Yeah, I'm a...
That is, I mean, I'm serious, that is a great motivator. It's like, oh, I'd like to go for a run with Barbara or Bob or whomever, and you go out and you get to spend time together, and that's actually a great motivator to do it.
I'm a CrossFitter, and we all like wilt at the thought of going more than a mile.
I know. CrossFitters are hilarious. Because I did a CrossFit class, and all these guys are like leaning on the pulling ups and the weights and the leaps, and I'm just dying.
So,
and then we all go around, run around the block, and everybody's like, oh my God. And I'm like, bye.
So if you're out, I'm out.
All right, great.
Thank you.
All right.
Let's go over to this side. What's your name and what's your question?
Hi, my name is Carrie Kaplan, and I'm curious about the time that in your life that you remember that you really hit a wall, and how, what it was, and how you broke through it.
Running. Are you talking about running, or?
I am talking about running.
You are talking about running. there have been times, and I'm trying to think of one. I mean, sometimes I've gone out there and it's just been miserable. Probably like the 2007 Boston Marathon, which I had qualified for, was just the most miserable experience. It was a 40-degree day. There was spitting rain right in our faces. It was like horizontal rain. It was like a nor'easter. The athletic village, the athletes' village where you start, was just sodden, so all of our shoes and feet were wet. We were all freezing, and we just ran that thing, and I just stumbled right into the medical tent, and I was like, what am I doing? This is the most miserable thing in the world. But one of the things I write about in the book is that one of the things you learn from running is that it eventually ends. And I mean that in a good way, because I got up the next day and it was another day, and then a couple days later I went for another run. And I mean, every run is itself, and some of them suck, and some of them are terrible, and some of them are bad. But unless you are injured, there's no reason you can't get up the next day and do it again. You're here.
Let's go over here for another question right behind you. Yes, what's your name and what's your question?
My name is Vaughn, and I'm really into ultras, and I wondered if you, I don't know if you've tried one?
No, I haven't, and a lot of people have asked me this question, and I say, at this point, I have to try one, because so many people, you have a t-shirt for the Tahoe 200?
Yes.
200 miles?
Yeah.
By yourself?
Well, this year I completed the triple of 200s, which was Bigfoot, Tahoe, and Moab in 3 months.
Wow. 3 months. So you run 200 miles by yourself. It's not one of these stage things. You're doing it.
Yes.
How long does it take you?
My fastest 200 was, and this is in the mountains with like over 40,000 of gain.
I'm gonna have you pause. Oh. And I want you to finish, but I just want to point out something. Every runner, before they tell you their time, will tell you their excuses. Every time. How'd you do in that race, Peter? Well, I stayed up too late the night before. Anyway, so now that you've established that it's a big elevation gain in the mountains, how long does it take you to run 200 miles?
My fastest is 53 hours, and my slowest is 98 because I had a 9-hour hallucination. And I... See, more excuses.
Do
I know.
Do you stop to sleep?
Yes, during the 200s you have to.
Yeah, it's about, because I was talking to a young woman today who ran with us who does 100s, and I asked her the same question, and she's like, nope.
No, 100s you don't.
100s you don't. Yeah, 100 miles. Come on. Well, I mean, all I can say is like that. I mean, people say to me, why would you run a marathon? That's insane. I'm like, why would you run 200 miles? That's insane.
Well, you know, I think it's more relaxed pace.
Yes, I know that.
You actually might you recover even a little faster.
Yeah.
And you're out in the woods, like you say, being in nature and being in tune. So to me, the longer I'm out there, the better.
Well, I think that's, I mean, all you're doing is you're taking the things I'm saying and you're just taking them to an extreme, so I have no argument with you. I mean, so,
thank you.
What do they say? Scale it up.
So I think you should try
I'm absolutely going to try, at this point, after so many people coming up to me, I have to try an ultra. Probably not 200 miles, though.
Okay.
I'll probably start small.
Like, thank you very much. We're gonna do one more question, and then we've got
A little thing I want to
closing remarks. What's your name and what's your question?
So my name's Marlene, and my question's a little bit more serious. You mentioned that the rule of law is what binds us together as a country.
Yes.
How are we going to bind ourselves together when half of us feel the other half are idiots?
That is a really good question. How are we going to bind us together when other half feels that they're idiots? Well, here's the thing. There has never been a time in America where we weren't at each other's throats. Everybody will say, well, you think this is bad? Well, back then, you know, in this election or that election, you wouldn't believe the slanders that were thrown. And there has been a tremendous amount of vicious partisan and political infighting in America. That's always been the case. But what has never happened is that we've never allowed that to come to blows, with one major exception. But here's the thing. The Civil War was not, I mean, I know this is going to sound like it wasn't really about slavery. That was the cause of the Civil War. But as Lincoln said himself, he didn't go to war to free the slaves. I think the famous quote in his letter to Josh Speed, is it? It's like, if I could save the Union by freeing all the slaves, I would. If I could save the Union by not freeing any slave, I would. If I could save the Union by freeing some and not others, I will. Lincoln fought the Civil War not to free the slaves, but to save democracy. And what he was doing was he was reacting to the Southern states saying, we just lost an election, we're out. Because that's what they said. They thought Lincoln would end slavery, so they didn't want to be part of the country anymore. And he knew, because he was Lincoln, that that is the hinge, that's where everything can go wrong. That's why at the Gettysburg Address, he talks with, not about slavery, but he says that these people perish so that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth. That's what he meant. He knew that if one part of a democracy is allowed to react to the loss of an election by leaving that democracy, it's the end of democracy. So other than that, we have managed our differences peacefully, vitriolically, but peacefully. And I continue to hope that that will be possible. The events recently are not encouraging in that regard. One of the things I'm watching with real alarm is the stuff that's going on with the election in Florida right now, because the Republican people, including the candidates for office themselves, are already saying this is rigged, this isn't right, this isn't fair. And if they end up losing, if Senator... If Rick Scott loses his bid for the Senate against Nelson, and he doesn't say, I accept the verdict of the people, congratulations to my opponent, I don't know what's going to happen. And I'm not looking forward to finding out. So I wish I had more encouraging news for you. I'm sorry. I need to work on being more encouraging. Here, I know what I'll do. Let me tell you, you may have mentioned my mentioning women running. One of the things that I'm aware of is that I, to use a phrase, am privileged that I am able to pursue this sport because I was raised in a place where I could do it and I have the freedom and I have the ability and the financial stuff. And this is a sport that is accessible, but not accessible enough. So one of the things I have been trying to do with this tour and this book is I've been trying to bring attention and support to some organizations that are bringing the gift of this particular sport to people who could use it, including an organization called Girls on the Run. And I've invited Kate from Girls on the Run Puget Sound to come on up. Come on up, Kate. Why don't you... This is Kate. So why don't you use, if that okay, that microphone right there, and you can talk to the people. Just take the microphone and step up on stage. I'd give you mine, but we'd have to stand uncomfortably close.
I thought I was going to be standing behind that podium, so excuse me. I'll do whatever. It's okay.
Sure.
All right, good evening, everyone. I'm thrilled to be here alongside you all for another wonderful sold-out town hall with Peter Sagal. My name is Katie Glenn, and I'm the program director at Girls on the Run of Puget Sound. We couldn't have been more excited to be invited here by Peter himself to share about Girls on the Run and our impact in the community. You may be wondering why Peter invited us, and he gave a little hint to that just now. But to put it simply, Girls on the Run aims to build confidence in girls through running. And to paraphrase what Peter mentions in his book, becoming a runner changed who and what I am, physically, emotionally, mentally. And we similarly hope to instill confidence and important life skills in the girls that we're reaching. So at Girls on the Run, participants learn critical life skills, such as how to manage their emotions, help others make intentional decisions, and resolve conflict. So skills that they use at home, at school, with their friends. A recent longitudinal study showed that 85% of our participants reported some improvement from pre to post season in measures of confidence, competence, character, connection, and caring. And they improved how much they liked the kind of person that they are and felt that others saw them in a much better light. which is pretty awesome, right? But wait, that's not all. After 10 weeks of running of this confidence-boosting, transformative running program, the season concludes with the celebratory 5K, which, Peter, I recently heard that you sometimes MC 5Ks.
So I do.
If you're
I
free.
I could be convinced to do it again.
which ours this year will be on May 19th. For most of our participants, this is the first time they've ever completed a 5K, and crossing that finish line is a really huge deal for them. Completing this 5K gives girls the tangible sense of achievement, as well as a framework for setting and achieving their goals. This spring, we'll serve 2,500 girls across King County at 200 different teams, and over 60% of them will receive some form of financial aid to do our program, which accounts for an estimated $250,000 raised by Girls on the Run Puget Sound. And because of our... Thank you. Yes. Because of our supporters, our girls lead healthier lives that bring them joy. They learn how to stand up for themselves and others and to honor their personal values. They are learning to lead compassionately and to be active and engaged citizens. Our girls are becoming more competent, more confident, and more engaged and about making a difference. Our community support is empowering girls to change the world. Thank you for being change makers with us and for believing in a world where every girl knows and activates her limitless potential and is free to boldly pursue her dreams. If you're interested in learning more about what we do at Girls on the Run, you can come visit our table in the back. Peter, thank you for inviting us tonight. This is wonderful to be here, and we'll see you at the finish line.
And can we get a big hand for Peter Sagal?
Thank you very much.